All right, so I'm gonna share my screen here and use right on my iPad. So my task in this lecture, as I understand it, is to give a sort of basic overview of a perspective on quantum phases of matter, a certain perspective on quantum phases of matter. And I'm gonna focus on ground states, on zero temperature phases of matter. And that that perspective is in terms of entanglement, in terms of, we'll see how to bring to bear some tools of quantum information theory. So just to give some context, the situation we're going to think about is a quantum system whose Hilbert space is a tensor product over points of space of some finite dimensional local Hilbert space. So I don't know, I'm going to draw, just because it's easiest to draw, a square lattice. So we'll imagine that, say, at each side or each, I don't know, let's be brave. And on each link, we're going to put some degrees of freedom. So this is some, this is the local Hilbert space, these little black dots I'm drawing. And the important thing is that those Hilbert spaces are finite dimensional, say a qubit. And the Hamiltonian, we're going to specify the system by specifying a Hamiltonian, is we're going to assume that it's local. So in particular, it's a sum over points in space of some Hamiltonian, which is associated with one of those points in space. So what I mean by that is that it acts, say, suppose this is the point x here. What I mean by hx is some pattern of operators involving those local degrees of freedom, which acts, say, on some finite number of nearby degrees of freedom. And so an important notion here is this distance here is the range of hx. So that's the how far away you have to go before h sub x stops acting on the degrees of freedom. So this is, yeah. So the important thing is that it's local. And it's a sum over points in space. I won't always assume that it's translation invariant, but I will always assume that it's what you might call motivic. What I mean by that is the same pattern of operators is repeated over the whole space. So it's not like there's some special place where there's a chicken and some other place where it looks like some other crazy thing. It's same kind of operators that appear, and maybe the coefficients vary in space. And okay, a little more context. The crucial, so this lattice has a size. Let's see, so first of all, there's a lattice spacing, something like this distance here is the distance in space between the sites. And then the way we grow the system is by adding more chunks of space. So there's some size of the system L. So the number of sites is something like L over A to the D, where D is the number of space dimensions. And we're going to be interested in the thermodynamic limit. So the magic happens, so, because that's where the magic happens. So thermodynamic limit. Where, you know what, let me call this L times A. So L is the number of sites, the linear number of sites in a linear direction, and the thermodynamic limit is L goes to infinity, because that's where emergent phenomena occur. That's sort of where something interesting can happen. And so perhaps the most basic question we can ask about this situation is how many degrees of freedom are there at the lowest energies? So how many degrees of freedom at the smallest possible energy? So energies below any scales in the Hamiltonian, any interesting energy scales in the Hamiltonian. And what I mean by degrees of freedom here is excitations of the system that can be made by acting with a local operator. And so, for example, as one would do in an experiment where one scatters a particle off of this chunk of material. And okay, so the answer to this question, this is a classification of phases of matter. Well, there are three possibilities. And you know, the first one is none, and the second one is some, and the third one is a lot. Okay, that's my classification of phases of matter. And this classification is useful. It has quite a bit of explanatory power. Perhaps the best thing it explains is is how desperate we are. So as you know, as we go to the right in this picture, the level of desperation increases. What I mean by that is we understand less and less as we go to the right. So I guess maybe a more presentable way to say that is that as we go to the left, our understanding increases. So a lot of what I'll say will be restricted to the left end of this picture, but I'll do my best. So to be a little more precise about what I mean by this classification, let's go back to item one here. What do I mean by none? Well, what I mean by none is let's suppose is the following. That's a situation where the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, the energy spectrum, looks like this. So there's a ground state, and then there's a gap, and then there's, oops, that was the wrong button. Then there's some excited states. And the crucial thing here is that this separation between the ground states and the excited states, delta, is finite, and not only finite, but finite in the thermodynamic limit. So, you know, if you take a photon, and a photon field, electromagnetic field, and put it in a box of size L, of linear size L, put it on a circle of size L, the spectrum will be something like energy is N over L. And so if L is finite, that there is a gap. But what I mean by none here, so this is what's called a gap system, is that even in the thermodynamic limit, the number of degrees of freedom is, the space between the ground state and the first excited state is finite. And it'll be useful, actually, to be a little bit broader in our scope of what we mean by a gap system and allow there to be a finite number of ground states below the gap. So, and furthermore, that those ground states here have some spacing between them, and I'm also going to assume that in the thermodynamic limit, that spacing between this finite number of ground states. I said the wrong thing. So somebody should have yelled at me here. So what I mean by a gap is that this limit is finite, it's bigger than zero. Okay. Gap is non-zero. But the spacing between this finite number of states is fine. Okay, so now I have to do the first exciting transition here, which is I'm going to take a screenshot of this blackboard and put it over here. Let's see. Here we go. Okay, so then I can turn the page. Good? Okay, so that's what I mean by none. And in that case, the excitations of the system are generally some kind of massive particles associated with this these excitations here. The second case, what I mean by some, is generally something like massless particles, like, say, a photon. Excuse me just one second. Let me close my door. Sorry, I thought I was all alone in my physics building here, but there's something going on in the hallway. The second case, some low energy degrees of freedom, is the following. So let me assume for simplicity that the system is actually translation invariant, so that I can label the states by conserved momentum. And what I mean by some is gapless degrees of freedom at isolated points in momentum space. So for example, here's a picture of the dispersion relation of a photon. There's a special point at k equals zero where there's a gapless excitation. Another example would be graphene, which has a dispersion relation for electrons that looks like this. Also in this category, I would include critical points. The gapless excitations at a critical point generally are also associated with particular points in momentum space. And I emphasize this to distinguish it from the case that I mean by a lot, which is where the picture in momentum space, let me draw it in higher dimension. So here's K space, looks something like this, where there's a whole locus of finite dimension, of dimension bigger than zero, of gapless degrees of freedom. And so this is what happens when there's a Fermi surface. And such a thing can be a Fermi liquid, in which case we understand it, or a non-Fermi liquid, in which case we're trying. Okay, so that was my classification. And so now we're gonna go back over that and think about it from a different point of view. Okay, so let's go back to the case of gapped systems, and let me try to define what I mean by a gapped phase. So I need to define this word phase. So let's think about the space of Hamiltonians. So here, the coordinates on the space of Hamiltonians are coupling constants. So G1 is the coefficient of some particular operator in the Hamiltonian. G2 is some coefficient of some other particular kind of operator in the Hamiltonian. And as we move around in this space, that gap, this delta, is a function on this space. And in general, it's not zero. And the condition that it equals zero, delta equals zero, is one real condition on all of these variables. And so there's some locus which has codimension one. We specify one combination of these variables, which is where the gap closes. And these walls of gap closing separate what we'll call gap phases. So in particular, let's declare that two Hamiltonians are equivalent if there's a path in the space of Hamiltonians that goes from one to the other without crossing this wall of gaplessness. And so these two guys are in the same phase, and someone over here looks like they could be in a different phase. Okay, so now there's an annoying thing about this definition, which is why I say it looks like it could be in a different phase, which is that, you know, this is some very high dimensional space of Hamiltonians. And how do I know that there isn't some other direction I can go out of the page or around somewhere to go around this wall of gaplessness to get from H3 to H1 and H2? And so wouldn't it be nice if there were some kind of label that we could compute in terms of the Hamiltonian, just in terms of H1 and H2, which would tell us whether there would necessarily be a wall of gaplessness between them. And something which if you force it to vary smoothly, has to be constant, and can only change by jumping at the wall of gaplessness. So this is, you know, this is the very definition of topology, something which can't change smoothly. This is how topology comes into the business, and an important goal then becomes to figure out what such labels might be. Okay, so here are some examples of what such labels might be. So two classes of such examples of such labels. The first one is topological order. So something which if you force it to vary smoothly has to be a constant. A good example of that is something which has to be an integer, right? An integer has this annoying property that it can't vary continuously from one to another. And so here's an example of such an integer. Let's think about the number of ground states. So recall we drew this picture of the spectrum where there's some number of ground states below the gap. And that number of ground states is something which, well, it depends on various things. So it, of course, it depends on the choice of Hilbert space and Hamiltonian. but it can also, in principle, depend on the topology of the space on which we put the system. So for example, we could put the system on some interesting space, I don't know, like say a torus, or maybe if we're feeling brave, some more sophisticated pastry. And it could be that the number of ground states depends on the topology of space. And so that's one way to define topological order. You get a different answer for the sphere, for the torus, or for higher genus pastry. And a crucial extra addition here that I better make is that it depends stably on the topology of space. So meaning, if I vary the geometry a little bit, or if I vary the, no, I better not say that, if I vary the Hamiltonian a little bit, that the number of ground states doesn't suddenly change, that the degeneracy isn't suddenly split. And so a necessary condition for this definition to be realized is that those ground states, to get from one to the other, you have to act with some operators, but it had better be that the operators that take one of these ground states to another one had better not be local operators. So that is, the matrix elements between these ground states of local operators in the thermodynamic limit had better be zero. And there's a simple reason for this, which is just that local operators are the things by which we're allowed to perturb the Hamiltonian. And if we, you know, if this were not the case, we would add this local operator to the Hamiltonian, or rather a sum of the local operators to the Hamiltonian, times some coupling G. And as a function of G, what was our beautiful ground state degeneracy would split. The levels would repel each other, and that would violate this, what I mean by stable. Okay, so this fact that that the ground states of topologically ordered systems are, you can't get from one to the other by the action of local operators, is, means that this ground state subspace behaves like a quantum error correcting code. In the sense that you can encode some quantum information in which of those states, some linear combination of those states, and errors in the form of acting with local operators on those states can be corrected in the sense that you know which of those states you're in still, because you can't get from one to the other by a finite number of local operators. And so there's this nice notion of code distance. Code distance is how many errors you can correct, which in the interesting statement here is that goes like some positive power of the system size. Okay, so this is one way to define topological order. Another symptom, very interesting symptom in terms of which you could also define it is anions. So that is particles or some kind of excitations, which cannot be created by a local operator. Cannot be created by a local operator. And so such things are called anions. At least when they're particles, they're called anions. Okay, so at this point, I guess I should give an example.
John, I want to interrupt you with a question real quick.
Wonderful.
Before you cover the previous page. The question is actually about the earlier page, the bottom part on gap phases. It's from Nadi Seiberg, and the question is, what happens if we vary G1 and G2 and the system undergoes a first order transition?
Great. Yeah, so Nadi, thanks for this question. So yeah, so an important comment, which I should have made, I think, is that this wall of gaplessness is not necessarily all continuous phase transition. So in particular, also at a first order phase transition, the gap closes. So maybe, here, you know what, let me just draw it on a new page. So at the wall of gaplessness, the picture of the spectrum could look like this as a function of G. So G is some combination of G1 and G2. It could look like something like that.
Sorry, we can't see that. I think it's covered by the other sheet.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for looking out for me. Okay, so it could be that the spectrum looks like this as a function of G, in which case this is a continuous transition, and you know this place is the location of the wall of gaplessness, or it could look something like this. So the continuum could be up here, and the wall of gaplessness is here. There's a first order transition. So it's still true that the gap closes. At such a transition. Those can be different phases. They need not be because of a line of first order transitions can end. So I think, I'm sticking by definition. Did that answer the question? I can't see Naughty's scowl. Okay, I'm gonna proceed, hoping that was helpful. So I'd better give an example. The example I want to talk about is the toric code, or Z2 gauge theory, or rather a special place in the phase diagram of Z2 gauge theory, where the correlation length is zero. I'm just going to describe the form of the ground state. You'll have to trust me, and I'm sure you'll hear more later about a lovely Hamiltonian for a spin system, which whose ground state this is. And so here's the crucial thing about here's the form of the ground state, a representative ground state of this phase. It's the sum over loops, over closed loops C, of a state which is labeled by the trajectory of that closed loop. So I'm drawing the closed loops in red here. And this cylinder here is just a picture of the space on which I've put the system. And so this is, I guess I should say, it's proportional to an equal weight superposition of all of these configurations of closed loops. And the reason that I say a ground state, so this is a ground state, is that if the space on which we put the system has non-contractible loops, which this space, this cylinder does, then there we can make another ground state, which is orthogonal to this one, by including in each of these configurations of loops also a loop which winds around this non-contractible cycle. So I claim that this the second ground state I've written is orthogonal to the first one, just because the Hilbert space of whether or not I put a loop on a given bit of space is an orthonormal basis for the local Hilbert space. So you see, if there were not a non-contractible loop, there would be only one ground state. And so this is a mechanism by which the number of ground states depends on the topology of space. Moreover, in order to get from ground state one, from ground state zero to ground state one, we have to act with an operator, let me just call it O, which, it's the point is that it has to create this giant loop, which is macroscopic. The important thing is that, this direction of the cylinder here is of order the system size. So this is not you know, very much not a local operator. So that this is like the logical operator in this quantum error correcting code. And moreover, from the same using the same language, I can describe how to make an anion. Or actually, I can't describe how to make one anion. I can describe how to make two, which is we take one of these ground states, either one, and act with an operator, which has one of these which creates these one of these loops. Except we allow it to end. So this is a state with anions. It's a state with anions at x and y, where this is x and y. Okay. So that's my example, and of course it's very illuminating to think in more microscopic detail about how one realizes such a phase, but I'm going to not do that right now in interest of time. Okay, so one more refinement of this way of something being topological that I should mention is that sometimes there's a nice theory of these ground states, these ground states whose number depends on the topology. Here, let me just say sometimes there exists an effective field theory for those ground states of these topological ground states, which is actually a field theory in terms of topological field theory, which is, you know, a big and relatively well developed subject, and in such a case we'll call the state a liquid. Basically, because it's something you can pour onto the space and to form smoothly, and by now we know some contrasting examples to that, which still have topological order. They still have a stable ground state degeneracy that depends on the topology, in particular, of the space in which we put them, but for which there isn't a traditional topological field theory description of those of those ground states, and so that's fractals. Okay, so that was the first way in which we can distinguish, but the way in which we can find the first kind of label that we can find on a phase, so that we don't have to look for every possible wall of gaplessness surrounding it. We can just count the number of ground states on a torus. A second example of a distinguishing label that we can place on a system is if it has edge modes. So it could be that if I place the system on a closed space, its spectrum is gapped. There's a finite gap in the thermodynamic limit. But if I cut the space open, that is, if it has a boundary, that there must necessarily be some kind of degeneracy of the edge, such as gapless edge modes. And there are some states of matter which have this property, which are fully characterized by their edge modes. And such a thing is called an invertible phase, invertible states, which includes, as special cases, symmetry protected topological states and topological insulators. So this means that the state is fully characterized by its edge modes. And in order for this to be the case, it must be that those edge modes carry some property, some intrinsic property, that can't be reproduced intrinsically on the edge by some local lattice ball that you could just paint on there. Because if that were the case, then it wouldn't characterize the bulk. And so that property, which does the characterizing, is called an anomaly. Okay. And, you know, a picture for why you might think that a gapped state, which is a distinct phase of matter from, say, the vacuum, from nothing, or from a trivial phase, or between such gapped phases, why you might think that there would be interesting edge modes, is that let's draw a picture of the evolution of couplings in a situation where, I don't know, say over here I'm in phase A, And then there's a wall. So this is just direction of space now. And suppose over here I'm in phase B. In order to do that, that means that the coupling constants, so I'm varying some coupling between A and B, the coupling constant that I have to vary to get from A to B must do something like this, right? So here, this is the value of G that puts us in phase A. This is the value of G that puts us in phase B. And in between, it has to vary. And that means that at some point in between, it has to cross the wall of gaplessness, right? Because the definition of A and B being in different phases is that in between, you have to cross the wall of gaplessness. So somewhere in there is this Hamiltonian, which if you had that Hamiltonian everywhere in space, it would be gapless. And that's the Hamiltonian along some wall in between here. And so you might think that maybe something interesting has to happen there. But actually, it's not always the case. So for example, the torque code can have gapped boundaries, can have an interface with vacuum where nothing interesting happens. So this intuition actually can be foiled by topological order, but it is true for these sort of more simple states. Okay, so that was ways in which gapped phases can be interesting. By interesting, I mean distinguished from, say, an atomic insulator where nothing.
John, I want to interrupt you for one more question, actually.
Wonderful.
So this one is from Kyle Kawago, and it's about the use of this term Stabley, which came up a couple times, talking about, for example, ground state degeneracy of topologically ordered states and also fractons. So the question is, what exactly is meant by depend Stabley? Is the statement you made about this property a consequence of the definition or the definition itself?
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. So thanks for that question. So what I mean, so actually it is part of the definition. So if you could imagine some weird system where only for some particularly finely tuned Hamiltonian, there was some, you could find a torus where the number of ground states is something and a sphere where the number of ground states is something else. But included in the definition of topological order is that there's some open set, possibly small open set, in the space of Hamiltonians around this point. So that is, you're allowed to perturb it by arbitrary local operators with small coefficients where this property is maintained. And so this condition on the matrix, the fact that local operators act in the ground state subspace as the identity, that they don't take one of these ground states to another, is, yes, I do mean that as part of the definition. And that's all. That also holds for any kind of topological order phase, including fractals. Yeah, good. Yeah, thank you for getting me to clarify. Okay, so we were on here. Okay, so now, so that was all about gap phases. And so now let me say a little bit, let me be brave and move down the classification by desperation a little bit. And let me say something about gaplessness. Gaplessness, it's something which needs explanation. What I mean by that is gaplessness is it's actually a sort of extreme example of this kind of finite degeneracy, which I just finished saying, is only stable if there's something that prevents local operators from mixing those ground states. If there were local operators that mix those ground states, small perturbations of the Hamiltonian by those local operators will split the degeneracy. In the case of gaplessness, the same is true. If you can relate different states of the photon by some local operator that you can add to the Hamiltonian, it would give the photon a mass. The system wouldn't be gapless anymore. So what I'm saying is that the default expectation, if you just assemble a pile of stuff together in this sort of motivic arrangement and couple them together by some Hamiltonians, should be that there'll be a gap, and that it'll probably be a trivial phase. And there are various reasons for this point of view. The first is that if it weren't the case, we would have discovered all these things long ago, and we wouldn't think they were interesting anymore. More seriously, it's because of what I was saying about, if generic perturbations can mix the states, then they will. I've assembled an attempt at a comprehensive list of reasons that things can be gapless, which I think this list is the kind of thing that gets people worked up and will probably want to yell at me and ask lots of questions, but maybe let me try to say it briefly. So here are some reasons. So one reason is we can tune to a critical point. So that is tune to a part of the wall of gaplessness, which is a continuous phase transition. So notice that this requires some external agency, the giant hand of the experimenter, to accomplish, and it's not something which would just occur if you found the thing lying on the ground, and necessarily only occurs at higher codimension in the space of Hamiltonians. The second possibility is spontaneously breaking a continuous symmetry, in which case there are Goldstone modes, which are gapless, and included in this element is an explanation of why the photon is gapless. That arises from spontaneously breaking a continuous one-form symmetry, about which I don't have time to say more. Next, we could have a Fermi surface. I don't know yet how to explain that in terms of symmetries, as a consequence of spontaneously broken symmetries. I think that's a good goal. Here, basically our understanding is that it's protected by some kind of Fermi degeneracy pressure. Another possibility is that the system we're studying could be the edge of a topological phase, of an invertible phase. So that the modes that we see as gapless are protected by some anomaly, which is labeling a gap phase in one higher dimension. There could be some symmetry which forbids mass terms. I guess that's that also includes the Goldstone case. But what I mean here is, for example, chiral symmetry. In particle physics, people make a big deal about the fact that chiral symmetry forbids fermion masses, and many explanations for why there's something other than nothing in the standard model involves this ingredient. And included here, I think we should also include supersymmetry, which relates boson masses to fermion masses, and therefore chiral symmetry prevents a fermion mass, and supersymmetry relates that absence of a fermion mass to a boson mass. And then finally, there's the possibility of a conformal field theory. Stability of a conformal field theory depends on its number of relevant operators, and there could be conformal field theories with no relevant operators. There are if you count ones that arise from broken continuous symmetries. I don't know of an example that's not of that form, but they could exist. There's a reference in my notes. By the way, I forgot to say, I wrote some notes which I posted on the Slack channel, I think that's the word, which say a little bit more than I'm going to have time to say aloud, and they have quite a few references. Okay, so that's my list. That's the end. If you think of other reasons for gaplessness, mention that. Ask in the Q&A. That'll be fun. I think we know that there have to be at least a few other reasons. Okay, so one thing to notice about gapless phases, the possibility of gapless phases, which is everything except for the first one. My definition of phase doesn't work anymore. I define phase as a thing surrounded by the wall of gaplessness where the gap is finite, and so that's no good. And so what I mean by a gapless phase is a region in the space of Hamiltonians where physics varies smoothly. So a region of the space of Hamiltonians within which, a good way to say it, is within which perturbation theory works. Okay, there's a bit more to say about that, but maybe that's enough to get us going. Okay, now the classification of phases of matter, I have to say, has an important refinement, which plays a very important role everywhere, which is that there can be symmetries. That is, we could restrict all these pictures I've been drawing of the space of Hamiltonians to a set of subspaces of Hamiltonians which are preserved by some symmetry. So that's like a slice of some kind of the space of Hamiltonians that we've been drawing before. And the shape of the wall of gaplessness may intersect that slice in very different ways and may separate regions that were not separated before. And so that's what leads to some very complicated refinement, which I'm not going to say anything else about that. That's the subject for another time. Because my subject is a different way of thinking about this space, which is by thinking about the entanglement. So to get started, let's say what entanglement is not. So a state of the form product over points in space of some state at each site is not entangled, I guess unentangled. So that defines what I mean by entanglement. Anything else? Such a state is exactly the variational ansatz that we make when we do mean field theory. And mean field theory is wonderful when it works. It predicts phase transitions, it predicts the critical theory in terms of the order parameter. And it even tells us about the excitation spectrum of the order state in terms of spin waves. But in some sense, this is we sort of completely understand this from some point of view, from this sort of experiment-free discussion of kinetic matter physics that I'm giving. Basically, the only thing we need to understand is representation theory of the symmetry group, because each site independently has its own experience of the symmetry and of the world. So in some sense, that's done. And the interesting thing is states which don't have that form. Two comments. So that here I've drawn a state which is completely unentangled. Within a phase whose representative this state is, there are states which are somewhat entangled. And our next job is going to be to try to quantify that and understand how those states are different from the entanglement of states where you can't reach a product state adiabatically. So to do better, so that was not entanglement. To do better, let's think about let's quantify entanglement. One way to do that, since we're talking about pure states, is to divide space. So this is space up into regions A and not A. So the Hilbert space, with our definitions, is a tensor product of the Hilbert space of A and the Hilbert space of not A, and given a state of this whole system, we can define the reduced density matrix for region A by tracing out its complement. This contains all the information about observations of operators contained within A. And its von Neumann entropy is called the entanglement entropy of A, will be the way that we'll quantify entanglement, which we can do because we're thinking about pure states. So lots of entanglement and mean field theory are antonyms, and the interesting thing will be states that can't be described by mean field theory. All right, so let me give a little bit of an interlude. I want you to think of this as an interlude on, let's say, on adiabatic continuation. So what can we say about two states that are in the same gapped phase? So the first thing I want to say about them is that, and I guess I've already been slipping into this abusive language, which is that the notion of quantum phase is a property of the ground state. I've defined it in terms of the Hamiltonian, but just as well we can think about it as a property of the ground state of that Hamiltonian, And, some evidence for this, which I'll explain a little bit, is, for example, in the case of a state with topological order, all of the data about the topological order, about the, for example, about the characteristic anion excitations, is encoded, are encoded in the ground state wave functions on the torus, or even in a single ground state wave function. Okay, so I can equally refer to equivalence classes of states as equivalence classes of Hamiltonians. So that was claim one. And claim two is a little more involved, is that two ground states are representative of the same phase, the same gapped phase, if and only if we can get from one to the other by a finite depth local unitary circuit. So that was a mouthful. I'm going to explain what I mean by finite depth local unitary circuit in the course of explaining this. So let me say it this way. So two states, ground state of H0 and ground state of H1, which are in the same phase, if and only if the ground state of H1 is obtainable from the ground state of H0 by some circuit, which I'll call U. So this is a finite depth local unitary. So to explain what I mean by that, let me demonstrate one of the directions of this claim. Okay, so let's think about this direction. So that is starting from two Hamiltonians, which we know are in the same phase. Let me construct what I mean by that circuit. So suppose you can get from H0 to H1 by some path of Hamiltonians, H of S. And importantly, the gap stays open for every, H of S is gapped for all S. Then one thing we can think about, a way to make it unitary, is adiabatic time evolution. So the adiabatic theorem says that if I do time-ordered exponential of h of t, so this is just time evolution from 0 to 1, starting on the state 0, that I get something which has some overlap with state 1. However, okay, which has some non-zero overlap with state 1, and then plus some amplitude for errors. Two comments about this. The first comment is the fact that the gap is independent of system size, right? The gap stays finite in the limit, in the thermodynamic limit, means that the amount of time evolution that we have to do here is finite, is independent of the system size. So I'm just evolving up to time one here. Okay, so that's good. So good is finite. It's a finite amount of time evolution. And a finite amount of time evolution can only do so much. On the other hand, there's something bad about this, which is that these errors, the errors that I've written here, the errors are extensive. And what I mean by that is that the probability of failure actually grows with system size. And so that's a problem if we want to find a unitary that maps one of these to the other one. But there's a way around this, which I think is due to Matt Hastings, which is called quasi-adiabatic filtering. And I'm not going to explain how to do this. The idea is we produce a new Hamiltonian from our original Hamiltonian, a new family of Hamiltonians from our original ones, which basically filter out the excitations near the gap, which would create these errors. And the crucial property is that if this one is local, so is this one. It's a local Hamiltonian which has the property that this psi 1 is exactly obtained by time evolution by this filtered Hamiltonian. Okay, so let's do that. There's no reason not to do that. Okay, so this produces a unitary U resulting from continuous time evolution by a local Hamiltonian. And now to say what I mean by a circuit, we can do what's called trotterizing this operator. So I've taken the liberty of drawing this picture beforehand because it's a little annoying to draw. What I mean by that is we can approximate this U. So time goes this way. This is the operator U. It acts on our Hilbert space. The number of legs here is the number of sites. We can approximate that because it's local. So we can approximate it by this sort of brick wall structure of elementary unitary gates. And this is just the operation that you do, say, in deriving the path integral from a canonical formalism. And so the crucial thing here, so this distance here is the system size. The crucial thing is that the depth of the circuit, I don't know, let's call it capital T, the number of layers of gates here is of order L to the zero. That's what I mean by finite depth. And that's a consequence of the fact that to achieve this U, so this is U, to achieve this U, we had to evolve only for a finite amount of time. Okay, so that was one direction of implication of the statement. So given two states in the same phase, we could relate them by this finite depth local unitary operator. And to go in the other direction.
John, maybe before you do that, there's a couple questions I want to interrupt you for.
Wonderful.
So it's actually a few different questions, but let me try to summarize. Yeah. It goes back a little bit to invertible states, and basically the questions are, what's the definition of an invertible state? And then also, another definition is that one can stack two invertible states and adiabatically connect the resulting state to a trivial gap state. Is that equivalent to the definition you gave?
Okay, good. Yeah, so thanks. So yeah, I didn't say very much about invertible states. Hopefully someone else will say more. The definition I gave of an invertible state is that it's completely characterized by its edge. That does imply that it forms an abelian group where addition is stacking and the inverse, then there exists an inverse that you can use to destroy it. Yes. Okay. I hope that answered the question. So are there more questions I should answer right now?
No, I think we're good for now.
Okay. All right. So let me explain the other direction of this claim of the relationship. So given a local unitary circuit of finite depth, we want to construct we want to show that we get two Hamiltonians in the same phase, and I'm going to assume that we can do trotterization freely, so I'm going to treat these things as the same. So I'm going to suppose we're given this local Hamiltonian. So basically, I'm going to assume that we're given this thing that we can evolve up to some time s, and we know that psi of 1 is u of 1 psi of 0. So let's just let psi of s equal u of s psi of 0. And then the claim is that this is a family of states which are ground states of gapped local Hamiltonians. And the reason is pretty simple. So remember, h0 is a sum of local operators, and it has a finite range. And the crucial point is that h-twiddle is, so let me define h-twiddle of S is this unitary acting on H. So the crucial idea, the crucial point is that, h-twiddle has range. Here, let me write it this way. Here we go. The range of h twiddle of x is, let's call it c twiddle. The thing we know about it is that it's independent of L, it's independent of system size, and the range of this u of s h twiddle x u of s dagger, it's obtained from this local operator by acting with this finite depth circuit. But now there's a crucial property of finite depth circuits, which is that they have a light cone. If I ask about, suppose I mess with this guy right here, its consequences can only propagate within some light cone here, only within some region of the circuit, with some speed, which you can infer from that picture. Suppose V max is the biggest it ever is. The range of this is the range of this guy plus that V max times the time of motion. And so this is, importantly, this is also independent of L. This is also a local operator. Oh, and of course I didn't say that every one of these guys is gapped, because we're getting it by conjugating by a unitary, a Hamiltonian, which is gapped. So the spectrum is the same. So that shows the other direction too. I get to draw this pretentious little thump. Okay. So this relationship between two things being in the same phase and being able to get from one to the other by a local unitary circuit of finite depth is a very important ingredient in this way of thinking. And so notice a consequence of this. If I define trivial phase to be one which has a representative, which is a product state, then what we've just shown is that there's no way to get from such a state to, say, the toric code ground state, to any state that has a that's in a distinct phase. So ground state of toric code is not equal to finite depth unitary acting on product state. Good. So now the next question that we should answer is, if we move around within the trivial phase, we can create entanglement, right? By, you know, within this light cone, we're entangling the degrees of freedom. But there's something about that entanglement that's different from the entanglement of, say, the toric code ground state. And it would be nice to be able to characterize exactly what's different. And so this will, I guess, by the way, I should have said, the name for states like this is short-range entangled. And the name for states like this is long-range entangled. There's a little bit of argument about exactly what long-range entangled means, but everybody will agree that the toric code ground state is long-range entangled. So let's see if we can distinguish between long-range entanglement and short-range entanglement by some simple measurement. In particular, let's think about the entanglement entropy. So So let's ask, what is the form of the entanglement entropy of the subregion for states which are obtained by finite time evolution of a product state by a local Hamiltonian? And you know, the crucial idea is, here's some region A, and the region A is entangled with its complement only through some shell. The shell has a width which is, well, we don't know exactly what it is, but it's related to that, the range of that circuit that we just talked about. And the crucial thing is it's finite. So if I take these regions to be big enough, all of the entanglement occurs on this you know, this narrow surface associated with the boundary of A. And so it's pretty plausible that for big enough regions, big enough compared to the correlation length, and of course the lattice spacing, that short-range entangled states will have the property that we can develop a formula for the entropy as an integral over the boundary of A of some local density. Right, this is, so there's some function on this boundary, which if we integrate it, we can get the entanglement entropy. And moreover, in this long wavelength limit, we can develop a derivative expansion for this entanglement entropy density S. And let's focus for definiteness on D equals 2 for now. So for example, there could be a constant term, let me call that lambda. There could be a term proportional to the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. There could be a term proportional to the square of the extrinsic curvature. There could be other things. We integrate this whole thing along the boundary. So K is the extrinsic curvature.
John, I just wanted to let you know that we have 15 minutes left.
All right. I'll see what I can do. So now we can integrate this. If I integrate a constant, I get something linear in the length of the boundary. If I integrate, so the intrinsic curvature is 1 over a length, and so dimensional analysis says that this goes like some constant independent of the size of the boundary. And if I, if this, the square term goes like 1 over that, and so this is a series in the size of the boundary. And now here comes a crucial piece of input. For pure states, the whole system is pure. The entropy of A is equal to the entropy of its complement. That's okay, because the reduced density matrices have the same Schmidt eigenvalues, same eigenvalues. On the one hand, okay, and on the other hand, the extrinsic curvature of the boundary of A is minus the extrinsic curvature of the boundary of its complement, right? From the point of view of A, this is curving in. From the point of view of A bar, this is curving out. And so that has the remarkable consequence that this term can't contribute with our assumptions. So with our assumption of short-range entanglement, the term which goes like the size of the boundary to the zeroth power just can't be generated in the entanglement entropy of a subregion. And so therefore, if it's there somehow, it's not a consequence of the short-range entanglement that results from this kind of finite time evolution. So now we can ask, where can we get such a size of the boundary to the zero term? And so let's return to the toric code ground state and think about this picture in that case. So here's a picture of a region A. And let's take a snapshot of a toric code ground state, measure the locations of the strings. Well, you know, some of the strings will be entirely within A. Some of the strings will be entirely outside A. But then, interestingly, some of the strings will start outside A and then come in. And when they're in there, because they're closed, we know that they have to leave again. So in particular, the number of intersections between the strings and the boundary has to be even as a consequence of the fact that the strings are closed. And this is one bit of information which restricts the reduced density matrix of this ground state relative to just what a free product state would be. So this picture says that the ground state, the entanglement entropy in the ground in a, any ground state of the Turek code has the form of a bit that's proportional to the size of the area minus log 2. The minus log 2 is this one extra bit of information that the number of string crossings is even. And let's define this constant term. Let's call it gamma. So gamma equals log 2 for the Turek code. And so this area law term is some junk that's inevitable, and you can change it by changing the microscopic structure, by redefining the lattice somehow. But this topological entanglement entropy is a property of the phase. It's a way to characterize the form of the topological order. More generally, if our boundary had more components, the thing that went here would be this times the number of components of the boundary. Here, A only has one component. The boundary of A has only one component. Okay. It's instructive to figure out how to isolate this particular constant term from the sea of area law garbage. One way to do that is to consider a combination of regions whose boundaries cancel out. So let's think about some regions like this. This particular prescription is due to Levin and Wen. With the property that the boundary of AB plus the boundary of BC is the same as the boundary of B plus the boundary of ABC. By writing these things next to each other, I mean the union. I should have drawn them a little better. These are supposed to be lined up. So this means that if I combine the entropies of these things in the combination, in the following combination, this is just a name for it, which is the conditional mutual information, which is SAB plus SBC minus SB minus SABC, then the boundaries, the area law bits, and also the corner bits cancel. This thing is called the conditional mutual information, And one way to think about it is it characterizes the amount of information that A and C have about each other given the state of B. So if I tell you B, how much correlations are still left? And there's this very important property from quantum information theory, which is called strong subadditivity, which says that this quantity is positive. Well, that's actually the statement of strong subadditivity, that this combination of entanglement entropies is positive. And if you compute this in a in a two-dimensional gap state, if you compute this using this formula here for the, so here, let me write it this way. If S of any region is the area, is the size of the boundary times some number minus gamma, then this quantity is equal to twice gamma. So this quantity, this is a way to extract this topological entanglement entropy. And it's useful because it gives the following perspective. So if strong subadditivity is saturated, then there's a theorem that says the state rho ABC, the reduced SC matrix on the unit of these things, is completely determined, can be reconstructed by its marginals, by rho A, which is just trace rho BC, rho ABC, and rho B and rho C. So in particular, if this TE is zero, it means that the global state of the system can be reconstructed just from the local information. So that's the absence of topological order. One thing I should mention is that the TEE is a characteristic of the topological order. Rather, this combination for regions is a property of liquid phases. So let me emphasize this. For liquid phases, the TEE is, it's equal to some nice property of the topological order, which is log of the total quantum dimension. That's a property of the anions, which for abelian states like the Torah code is just the number of torus constants. There's an important exception for fracton phases, for non-liquid phases, where this quantity can depend on the geometry of the regions. Okay, so what I just said was for d equals 2, there's a similar statement in d equals 3, that again, there's one combination of entanglement entropies of regions, which is characteristic of the topological order. Okay, I'm running out of time. So maybe the further things that I had hoped to say were, first of all, something about characterizing what's special about ground states of local Hamiltonians, and trying to finding ways to parameterize those states relative to the vast ocean of volume law entangled states in the world. So maybe I should say a little more about this. The Hilbert space that I've just described is vast. Here, let me draw it like this. This is the Hilbert space. It's vast, right? It goes off the page. And a general state in the Hilbert space is, something like, a basis for the Hilbert space is I pick a basis of each site. There's 2 to the L to the D sites. And then I have to sum over a coefficient for each of these. Right, so this is 2 to the L to the D numbers. That's too many numbers, right? That's for any reasonable L, we can't even fathom that number of numbers. In contrast, mean field theory is this tiny corner of the Hilbert space, which is a tensor product over independent states for each site, which is only L to the D numbers. That's too few. And so somewhere in between, there's a, like somewhere here maybe, is all the states we care about. There's something special about them. So, I mean, I guess we care about things beyond ground states of local Hamiltonians, but there's something special about them. So one thing that's special about them is the area law. That is, they satisfy this condition that, let me write this as an expectation. general expectation, that the entanglement entropy of region A, whose linear size is R, in a ground state, of, so for ground states of local Hamiltonians, that this should go like R to the D minus 1 times some coefficient plus smaller terms. And this is a general expectation. It's rigorously true in one dimension. One way to implement it is using tensor networks. And maybe I won't say any more about that, since I guess Frank Pullman is going to give a lecture about that. But maybe I will say that there are some exceptions to the area law, real physical exceptions, which is CFTs in one dimension, critical points, have the property that the ground state entropy of an interval of length R, the entanglement entropy of an interval of length R is C over 3 log R over some short distance cutoff. So that whereas the area law in one dimension would say that it should be independent of the size of the region. In D bigger than one critical points, we expect to satisfy the area law. I don't know how to prove that. But in D bigger than one, a class of exceptions comes from metals. Metallic states, the states with a Fermi surface have SA goes like, again, some logarithmic violation of the area law, where the units here are made up by the Fermi momentum, the size of the Fermi surface. And actually, this statement can be understood from the previous one by thinking about each point on the Fermi surface as like a 1 plus 1 dimensional critical theory. And then, of course, there's a, so I should emphasize, not every state satisfies the area law. It's a special property of ground states. It's not even a property of equilibrium states. Let me emphasize that if we wanted to speak, for example, about finite temperature equilibrium states, then the entanglement entropy of subregions would be volume law. And with a coefficient that depends on the temperature, to some probably, which grows with the temperature. Does this mean that, well, the coefficient here is the thermal entropy density, does this mean that thermal states become highly entangled at high temperature, or that they become very quantum? And the answer is no, because this von Neumann entropy that we're computing here is not so good a measure of entanglement for mixed states. For mixed states, there can be entropy of mixture in addition to entropy of entanglement. This you should think of as measuring entanglement, local entanglement, with the bath, with the thermal bath that keeps the state in equilibrium. And for mixed states, we better use a better measure of entanglement, such as the entanglement negativity. Okay, Mike, how much time do I have?
2 minutes, maybe. Yeah, we have right, 2 minutes, maybe 1.5 minutes or something.
All right. So let me just wrap up. The final thing I wanted to say was an example of a way in which these ideas of thinking about entanglement and entanglement entropy and strong subadditivity are useful in many body physics, which is the notion of renormalization group monotones. Rather than writing a title, let me just write the statement that I want to write, which is the universal terms in the entanglement entropy of subregions, like this quantity gamma, like the TE that we defined, are in general renormalization group monotones. So like gamma and also like C, this quantity C appearing, the central charge appearing in the entanglement entropy of 1 plus 1 dimensional CFTs. So what do I mean by RG monotones? So the normalization group is, you know, this procedure by which we coarse grain degrees of freedom. We start with some microscopic model that has all these degrees of freedom that I drew, and we try to, you know, decimate those degrees of freedom in such a way as to keep only the ones that are important at low energies. And this procedure is hard to do, and so it's useful to know a priori constraints on what it can do. One, you know, very beautiful thing that we've learned is that these universal terms, meaning terms that you can't generate by short range entanglement, by local unitary evolution, by finite time, these universal terms in the entanglement entropy subregions can only decrease under the renormalization group, and therefore can be regarded as measures of numbers of degrees of freedom. Actually, the theorem that I'm referring to here has some assumptions. An important assumption is, first of all, it uses strong subadditivity. That's not an assumption, that's just a fact about quantum mechanics. But it does use Lorentz invariance. So it assumes that at long wavelengths, some kind of Lorentz invariance emerges and is being used to constrain the physics. So one example of an application of this idea is a nice paper by Thurer and Grover, where he uses it to constrain the whether or not algebraic spin liquids can emerge in certain Lasse models. In particular, you know, one way to phrase one of the questions he's asking is, in high energy physics terms, is how many flavors of charged Dirac fermions does one need in order to keep U1 gauge theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions from confining? And this is something where, by computing this, the analog of this TEE for this gapless system, he can constrain the possible phases that emerge. Okay, so that's an example of the kind of power of this point of view. And then finally, I want to just end with a warning that the perspective I've taken here is somewhat limited compared to the full scope of the world of ultra quantum matter. In particular, I've focused on ground states on t equals zero. So let me just list this as omissions. So I've focused on t equals zero here. Thinking about what happens at for excited states and for finite temperatures is quite important. And in particular, there's something very dramatic that I have to say about the examples I've given. So in most of the examples we know, nearly all of the examples we know of topological order, there's a finite temperature phase transit. There's a phase transition at t equals zero, so that at any non-zero temperature, it's adiabatically connectable to a product state. This is some sad news that I feel like I have to convey. So that's, you know, that's an important thing to understand, whether there are analogs of these phenomena at t bigger than zero in dimensions less than four. And then finally, not non-equilibrium things. I don't even know how to spell this word. Non-equilibrium matter can also be ultra-quantum, as we'll hear from Matthew Fisher later this week. Okay, so that's, I think that's a good place to stop. Thanks for your patience.